In a previous lecture, we talked about decision theory. In a nutshell, when choosing between two options, calculate the probability and the value of possible outcomes. Then pick that option that has the highest probability times value. Maximize expected utility. Decision theory, however, is really made for contexts in which there's just one decision maker, you. There you are, standing at the fork in the road. In that picture, the road taken and the outcome which eventuates are treated as if it was all about you. Most real-life decisions are not all about you. What happens may depend not only on what you decide to do, but on what you, Bill, Mike, the guy next door, Apple, IBM, and Microsoft all decide what decide to do. Where decision theory leaves off, game theory begins. It's designed to address, in an abstract way, rational decision in the social context, the context in which multiple players are making interlocking decisions. An understanding of game theory and an appreciation of its limitations should both be part of the philosopher's toolkit. Let me start with some history. Game theory goes back to John von Neumann, my candidate for the smartest man of the 20th century. Von Neumann was instrumental in the development of computers, the atomic and hydrogen bombs, and game theory. Along with Einstein, he was one of the first professors appointed to the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. The standard configuration used in today's computers is still called the von Neumann architecture. He played a major role in the Manhattan Project. He was responsible for the sphere implosion design used in the first atomic explosion at Trinity, New Mexico, and in Fat Man, the bomb dropped at Nagasaki. After the war, many of those involved wanted nothing to do with that kind of work again. Not von Neumann. He was even more instrumental in the development and testing of the hydrogen bomb. There are photographs of von Neumann at Ground Zero at the Bikini Atoll within a few months of the blast. It's still debated whether radiation exposure contributed to the cancer that killed him at the age of 54. What does his involvement with nuclear weapons have to do with game theory? A lot. It wasn't long after World War II that the Soviet Union had nuclear capabilities too. How do you conduct war? How do you negotiate your way out of it in a world in which both sides have that kind of killing capacity? You can't navigate that world as if you're the only decision maker who matters. You have to think through chains of action and response. If we do this, and they do this, and we respond like this, multiple decisions on both sides are going to matter, and are going to matter a lot. With the possibility of mutual annihilation looming, the stakes could hardly be higher. It was in anticipating a world with two nuclear superpowers that von Neumann developed game theory. The year was 1944. The book was von Neumann and Morgenstern, Theory of Games and Economic Behavior. The title sounds innocent enough, how amusing, games. But the real target was rational strategies for conducting a Cold War rather than a hot one. Games, in von Neumann's sense, aren't just checkers and chess. They include every situation involving cooperation and competition in which the outcome depends on the multiple actions of multiple players. There's one game, one situation regarding cooperation and competition that has become the central exhibit of game theory. You may know it. It's called the Prisoner's Dilemma. The story behind the game is the story of two bank robbers, caught and held in separate cells. Call them Al and Bruiser. You're Al. The DA comes in and says, "Look, I've got to admit our evidence is pretty thin. If you guys both stonewall, you'll get off pretty light. But if Bruiser confesses Al and you don't, we'll use his evidence against you. We'll let him walk and put you away for years." The same thing goes the other way around. If you confess and Bruiser doesn't, we'll let you walk. We'll nail Bruiser instead. And if you both confess, I have to admit we'd love that. You'd both do some time, all right, but with a little discount for the guilty plea. The question is, do you rat on your accomplice or not? The important point is that the outcome doesn't all depend on you. It depends on how the decisions by both prisoners play out. That's game theory. As in previous lectures, we could use a matrix to represent possible outcomes. I'll build it using positive values rather than negative. We'll talk about a maximum of 5 positive points. Those would be the number of years of freedom out of the next 5. Al is player A. Bruiser is player B. If you're player A, you have 2 options. You can defect against Bruiser by turning state's evidence, or you can cooperate with Bruiser by stonewalling. We'll call your 2 options defect and cooperate. Note that cooperate means to cooperate with your partner in crime, not with the police. B has the same 2 options, just like in the story. There are 4 ways this could come out, reflected in the 4 quadrants of our matrix. Both players cooperate with each other. Both defect against each other. A cooperates and B defects. Or A defects and B cooperates. We'll lay those out in this matrix with a box for each possibility. Payoffs for A are listed in red in each box. Those for B are listed in blue. Game theory is about how decisions interact. What the matrix shows is potential gains and losses for each side given different combined decisions. If one player plays nice by cooperating with the other player, and the other stiffs him by defecting against him, the defector walks away with 5 points, a full 5 years of freedom, say. The cooperator gets no years of freedom. You can see that in the upper right and lower left quadrants of the matrix. If both players choose to cooperate with each other, both end up with 3 points, 3 years of freedom. Pretty good. If both defect, they both end up with only 1 year of freedom. Not so good. So I put it to you, player A, should you cooperate with B or defect against him? What's the rational thing to do in the prisoner's dilemma? Press pause, think about it a minute, and then come back. So what are you going to do? Stay true and cooperate with your pal, or defect against him? If you said cooperate, you're an incredibly nice person. But the rational thing to do is to defect. This is a first major result in game theory. Look at it this way. You have no control over what the other guy does. But no matter what the other player does, you're better off defecting. Suppose the other player cooperates. If you cooperate, you get 3 points. If you defect, you get 5. So if he cooperates, you're better off defecting. Suppose the other player defects. If you cooperate, you get 0 points. If you defect, you at least get 1. So you're better off defecting in that case, too. So no matter what the other player does, you're better off defecting. That's what it means for a strategy to be strongly dominant. In a one-shot prisoner's dilemma, defection is strongly dominant. In real life, however, interactions are almost never a one-shot deal. Social life involves repeated interactions with the same people and the same organizations. Your relationship with your baker, your banker, or your partner in crime is almost never a one-shot deal. The parties to the transaction expect to interact again. That's going to make a difference in what behavior is rational. You and I will interact again, and how I treat you next time may depend on how you treated me this time. When we step up to this level, we're dealing with what's called an iterated game. In an iterated prisoner's dilemma, the payoffs on each round stay the same, but there isn't just one round. A and B play once, get their payoffs, and then play again. But of course, they remember what happened last time. Suppose you know that you and Bruiser will keep playing an iterated game. Suppose he burns you this time. You cooperated, but he defected against you. He walked away with 5 points. You ended up with 0. How is that going to affect your future play? In an iterated game, we're talking about the rationality not just of a single cooperator defect, but of strategies of cooperation and defection over time. A really simple strategy might be always cooperate. Simple, but probably not very rational. On the opposite end is always defect. But there are lots of more complex possibilities. There's one strategy that's of particular interest. It's called tit for tat. I'll start off cooperating, but whatever you do to me on a given round, I'll give back to you the next time. If you cooperate, I'll cooperate on the next round. If you defect on me, I'll defect on you next time. We know what it's rational to do in a one-shot prisoner's dilemma, defect. But in an iterated game, we're dealing with patterns of play on both sides. You might be playing against people with very different strategies on the other side. You might not know what their strategy is. What's the most rational strategy for you to play? Robert Axelrod is a political scientist at the University of Michigan. In 1980, he tried to get a handle on that question by running a computer-based prisoner's dilemma tournament. Anyone who wanted to was invited to submit a strategy. Submissions came in from game theorists in economics, psychology, sociology, political science, and mathematics. No philosophers, unfortunately. He set it up so that every submitted strategy played 200 rounds against every other strategy. Strategy 1 played 200 iterated rounds against strategy 2, then 200 iterated rounds against strategy 3, and so forth. He also made sure that every strategy played against itself, and also against an opponent that cooperated and defected at random. Axelrod added up the total points that each strategy gained in all those competitions. The winner was the strategy that got the most points overall. Some of the strategies submitted were very complicated. Strategies that kept track of the opponent's play, looking for weaknesses. Strategies that tested and probed the opponent's play, forming hypotheses regarding future action. What strategy would you suggest for Axelrod's tournament? When the dust cleared, there was a clear winner. The strategy that came out with the most points, the most rational strategy to play against that whole field of competitors, was tit for tat. Axelrod was flabbergasted. All those complicated submissions, and the one that did the best was one of the very simplest, tit for tat. Start off cooperating. If the other guy cooperates, do the same for him next time. If the other guy defects, do the same to him next time. What was even more surprising was the result of a second tournament. The winner of the first competition was announced. People were invited to submit strategies again. Clearly, tit for tat was the strategy to gun for. So, lots more complicated strategies designed this time to exploit weaknesses and to stump tit for tat. All strategies are pitted against all others in 200 iterated rounds. The winner is that strategy with the most points overall. The winner that second time? Tit for tat. Here's what's particularly amazing about all this. Tit for tat doesn't win because it smashes so many opponents. In fact, tit for tat never smashes an opponent. It never gets more points than the opposition. Tit for tat just mirrors the other guy's play, and the best it can do is as good as the other guy's play. So why did tit for tat win? Because it did better against the whole field of opponents than any other strategy did. It was particularly important that tit for tat did well against other cooperative strategies. In that case, both sides ended up cooperating, racking up 3 points every time. All those competitive strategies designed to exploit an opponent's weakness, and the one that does the best overall is a strategy of reciprocal cooperation. In the one-shot prisoner's dilemma, defect is the rational choice. But in repeated games played with lots of different players, like in Axelrod's tournament, and more like real life, The strategy that does best is one that starts by cooperating and returns like for like. That lesson from game theory sounds a little like a relative of the golden rule, doesn't it? It says that the rational thing is to do unto your neighbor as he does unto you. The golden rule says that the ethical thing is to do unto your neighbor as you would have him do unto you. There's a lesson from the tit-for-tat result. Cooperation may triumph even where one might have thought it wasn't possible. That's important. The limitations of game theory also have lessons to teach. Let me turn to those limitations and what they have to teach us about social rationality. I want to give game theory its due, but also look beyond it. The prisoner's dilemma is clearly an artificial setup, artificial enough to be captured in a matrix. That in itself isn't bad. Simplification is one of our most important conceptual tools. But there are several artificialities in that setup of which we should be particularly wary. First, note that everybody knows the rules, everybody knows the payoffs, and it's always clear to both sides whether an action was a cooperation or a defection. That's what's called a game of perfect information. Real life is often not like that. You don't always know the payoffs. In real life, your attempts at cooperation might be read as defections instead. Real life is certainly not a game of perfect information. Second, note that all moves are either full cooperation or full defection. There's no halfway here. What happens if an action can be somewhat but not fully cooperative? I've actually done some research along those lines, and the simple answer is, things get messier fast. More like real life. Finally, note that players have to play on each round. They can't just opt out. I'm just not going to deal with you anymore. People have also investigated formal games in which opting out is a possibility. The result? You guessed it. Lots more complex. Just like real life. For real social rationality, then, it's not enough to act as one would in game theory. For real social rationality, one also has to keep in mind that actions of cooperation and competition don't have to be all or nothing, may not always be clear, and that opting out of certain relationships may be an important possibility. Here's another limitation of the work I've outlined. All of the results we've been talking about are results in a particular game, the prisoner's dilemma. That particular game, that particular trade-off between potential competitors or cooperators has been the most studied game in game theory. Why? When you look through the literature, it turns out that no one has a very good answer. The game is fascinating. It does seem to capture something about individual gains versus social benefits. But there's no reason to believe that the prisoner's dilemma is the only game we play. The matrix values define the game. It's a prisoner's dilemma if the value of defecting against a cooperator is greater than the value of mutual cooperation, if that's greater than the value of joint defection, and if the real loser is cooperation in the face of defection. But nothing says that payoffs in all our everyday interactions line up like that. There are other named games with other relative values. Chicken is a game that functions like two teenage boys driving hot rods toward each other. The guy who pulls out first loses. He's the chicken, and everybody makes fun of him. But he doesn't lose as badly as both boys do if neither pulls off. The matrix values for chicken look different from those for the prisoner's dilemma. Stag Hunt is named after a game that appears in the work of the philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau, writing in the 1700s. Rousseau tells the story of two men hunting, each of whom can choose to cooperatively hunt stag or to go for an easier rabbit when one runs by. The big payoff here is for cooperative stag hunting. Anyone who goes for the rabbit can count on a much smaller payoff. The big loser is the man who's still hunting stag while his companion is gone for a rabbit. The matrix for stag hunt is different from both chicken and the prisoner's dilemma. The truth is that we have no reason to believe that any single game captures the balance of payoffs in all our different kinds of interactions. In different contexts, with different people, with different aims in view, we engage in very different games. Payoffs, relative gains, and the possibility of opting out differ across those different contexts. And of course, there are interactions where it's not just decisions of two players that are important, but three players, or four, or more. The wonderful thing about game theory is that it deals with a very real issue of rationality. How to deal with contexts in which the action of not one, but multiple players determine the result. The not-so-wonderful aspect is that it doesn't deal with that very real issue in a very real way. At least not yet. The research continues. Decision theory and game theory have one core characteristic in common. Both gauge rationality in terms of self-interest. In game theory, one's calculating how to maximize one's own gain on the assumption that the other players are doing the same. That's going to be applicable to real-life situations, however, only to the extent that people really act that way. Do they? Do people actually make decisions in the way that game theorists and economists in general regard as rational? The answer is that they don't. That's a major finding of the developing field of behavioral economics, which puts the standard assumptions to the test. The truth is that people systematically violate the economists' canonical assumptions of rationality. They violate them in a variety of different ways. There is a simpler game that's used in many of these studies. It's called the ultimatum game. You and another person meeting for just one time have to split an amount of money, equivalent to a couple days' wages, perhaps. One person is randomly chosen as the proposer. The other person is the responder. Here's the interaction. The proposer gets to propose how the money is to be split. 50-50, perhaps, or 90% to him and 10% to the responder. The responder then gets to choose whether to accept that division or not. If he accepts, the money gets divided as the proposer proposed, 50-50 or 90-10 or whatever. But if the responder declines the division, neither side gets any money at all. So think about that for a minute. Put yourself in the place of the proposer. You've got $300 to divide. What would you propose? Now put yourself in the place of the responder. Suppose the proposer suggests that he gets $270 and you get $30. Would you accept that $30, or would you tell him to shove it, with the result that you both walk away with nothing? Okay, we know what you would do. Here's what economic rationality says that you should do. If you're the responder, you should take any division that gives you any money at all. Why? Because something is better than nothing. If he proposes $30 for you and $270 for him, you should take it. Better something than nothing. Indeed, if he proposes 30 cents for you and $299.70 for him, you should take it. Better something than nothing. What's the rational thing to do as proposer? If the other person is rational in the way just outlined, and you're just out for the money, you should propose as much as possible for you and as little as possible for him. Because he's rational, he'll take it. Because you're rational, you'll walk away with a bundle. Homo economicus is the name that has been given to agents who act as the economic game theorist says they should. One of the primary articles on the issue is titled In Search of Homo Economicus. Is there such a species? Evidently not. In industrialized societies, proposers tend to offer something like a 44% cut to the other side, not close to zero, as Homo Economicus would. Sampling across a whole range of societies across all continents, virtually no proposer offers less than 25% to the other side. But the variability by culture is immense. The Torgud people of Mongolia and the Mapuche of Chile offer about 35% to the other side. The Achuar of Ecuador and the Sangu of Tanzania offer 40% to the other side. The Ache of Paraguay offer an average of 51%. My favorite are the Lamalera of Indonesia. Their proposers offer a full 58% to the other side. We have to split the money? Okay, you take more. Anthropologists and economists have tried to figure out what it is that explains those variations. The answer seems to be the different cultural patterns of everyday life. The more cooperative work is involved in a culture, like the whale-hunting Lamalera of Indonesia, the higher the offer to the other side in this artificial game. It's also true that the more a culture incorporates a market economy, the higher the offer to the other side. What of rejections? In industrialized societies, offers of less than 20% tend to be rejected. In other cultures, almost no offer is rejected. But the Ao and the Ganau of Papua New Guinea reject both high and low offers. They will reject offers they think are unfair, even if it's unfair to their benefit. Offer an Ao 58% and he'd rather you both walked away with nothing. What I've tried to emphasize in this lecture is social rationality. As of now, the best formal tool we have for that is game theory. It at least recognizes the issue that decisions made jointly may have a different rationality than those made individually. Game theory supplies some simple models. It even offers some hope for emergence of cooperation in egoistic situations like the prisoner's dilemma. Its limitations, when applied to real life, carry lessons as well. It may not always be clear whether our real-life moves are cooperations, defections, or something in between. The game we're playing in real life, the payoffs to each side, may be far from obvious. Indeed, the game itself may be open to negotiation. The motivations of the multiple players won't be as predictable as purely rational models might lead us to believe, and might well depend on differences in cultural background. I want to close with another aspect of social rationality that goes significantly beyond game theory. In order to make decisions rationally, even individual decisions, the first requirement is information. Often it's social means that make that information available. Wikipedia is a testament to social interaction as a source of information. It's also a testament to the unselfish motivations of thousands of anonymous volunteers, unselfish in a way that seems to defy the assumptions of game theory. It's still true, however, that you should check and double-check information that comes from that kind of source. We talked about the wisdom of crowds in an earlier lecture, which is also a way of reading information off social sources. Here's another. The previous lecture began with Richard Feynman and the Challenger disaster. Let me end here with that same case, but with a different message. There it was Feynman's experiment that was the focus. Here, I want to put the emphasis on information that can be read off social action. In the Challenger case, there were four major contractors who manufactured components that might have been at fault: Rockwell International, Boeing, Martin Marietta, and Morton Thiokol. When the spacecraft disintegrated, it might have been any one of those that was to blame. The Rogers Commission made their final report 6 months later. Feynman was ahead of the curve. He did his experiment in front of the television cameras just 2 weeks after the incident. But there was information of a social sort that beat even Feynman. When the incident happened, stock in all of those manufacturers took an immediate hit on Wall Street. Stock prices for Rockwell International, Boeing, Martin Marietta, and Morton Thiokol all fell immediately. But by the end of the day's trading, three were starting to recover. One of the four just kept falling. It was Morton Thiokol, the company that made the O-rings. My guess is that there was information out there that indicated Morton Thiokol as the probable source of the problem. That information became apparent in the actions of people who knew. Even if you were entirely ignorant regarding the technology involved then, you might have been able to read off the relevant information from social behavior. You could have beaten even Feynman to the punch by weeks just by watching stock market activity on the day of the disaster. In the next lecture, I want to talk about another tool in the philosopher's toolkit, another type of thinking of increasing importance, thinking with models.